Do you live in Chicago?
I grew up in Chicago, but I live in Boston
now.
Boston?
I think WBBM in Chicago is one of the few CBS-owned stations that doesn't carry BookBeat.
Uh-huh.
It would be nice to have it there. St. Louis carries it, then. It's, uh-huh, close to the Midwest.
Yeah.
So, well, let's talk about family pictures, then I'd like to ask a couple of questions, sure, about you. Tell me about the family in family pictures, because they seem typical in many respects, and like most families, also different.
Yeah, I think sort of the first half of the family is very typical of that era in particular, the 50s, and the late 40s and 50s. They're a young married couple after the war. The father's a physician, a psychiatrist, and the mother is happy at home raising her children. And they plan to have three children, which is pretty standard, as one of the daughters says, in their world. And then I think the difference begins, at any rate, when they discover that the third of these first three children that they have is autistic, is diagnosed as autistic. And then, in a kind of desperation, the wife, the mother, goes on to have three more children, almost by herself. At any rate, the father is not happy with the additional strain on the family of these three children. There are various divisions that occur between the two parents.
I believe he calls them the unexpected visitors.
Yeah, the unexpected guests, or the surprise party, or the last straws, that sort of thing. I mean, he's very close to them, and they're very attached to him, but he does also have this ironic sense of the way they were born, how they came to be in this world also, also, I think, a real sense of how much extra they are for this family, which is already strained almost to its limit, how much extra strain they put on the family.
Well, David has his vulnerabilities. He also, in many respects, seems larger than life because of his ability to deal with people in a calm, rational way.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the children respond variously to that. I mean, as they grow up, he's very much a favorite when they're younger, it seems, and then in some way they, I think, begin to feel treated by him, that there's a kind of almost clinical distance that he keeps from them, that they feel to a varying degrees at various times in their lives with him.
I think that's probably also best represented by Mac as an adolescent, where he is obviously rebellious and talks back to his father in, mm-hmm, a way that I don't know how many fathers would tolerate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think actually some of that has to do with the milieu and the time. That is, it's this sort of crazy, quasi-bohemian university community, the University of Chicago, which is sort of the most very intensely intellectual place. And, you know, there's this sort of sense of the great freedom accorded to these children, granted to them to, you know, to use foul language. And particularly then, as the 60s progressed, the parents really don't, in this book anyway, correct them, stop them. They really are granted an enormous autonomy. And one of the aspects of that is that they talk very freely to their parents about what they're feeling when they're angry. They tell them in various forms to get lost. And I think that probably, it's hard to remember exactly that time, how passionately that language was seized on, politically almost, and how very commonplace it became for, I mean, I think we have clearly the vestiges of it now, but I think it was embraced as a kind of, you know, expression of something.
Now, strangely, Randall is almost, in many respects, a solidifying factor in the family, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, clearly he's the one whose presence provokes the difficulty in the family. But it's clear, or I wanted it to be clear, actually several of the characters speak of it, that he provides a very special bond for them all. There's some way in which they have all gone through the same fire, the same experience, which is his presence among them, and have to come to terms with it. And they're bonded in some sense or another by that common experience in a way that most families really aren't. The experience of most families is perhaps more disparate, but all of them must deal with Randall. All of them must make some sense of him in their lives.
The majority of perspective in the book seems to be from Nina, because not only is there a third person narrator, but there is a first-person narrator in Nina. Can you tell me about how you conceptualized this book in that regard?
Well, some of that may be a failure to conceptualize it very well at the start and a sort of floundering for a while with voice and the question of exactly how I was going to write the book and what voice it was going to be in. And one time or another, I thought it might be a first-person novel, but I very much wanted it to be a third-person novel. I wanted to sort of to make myself do that, to sit on the shoulder of these very different characters and to get very close to them narratively. On the other hand, I ended up feeling that there was a certain kind of slant on it all that I could get by having one of the characters emerge as sort of the interpreter of all of this experience. And so I chose that funny mix. There are three chapters that Nina narrates in the first person, and then all the rest of the chapters, I forget how many there are, but maybe 14 or something like that, move around in the third person among the characters. And I also did Nina in the third person, too. That is, there are various stages at which she's being talked about in the third person, but in a more ruminative way, a more speculative way, maybe a more discursive way. She also has these three chapters in which she discusses and interprets her family and their life to them.
And not only that, she brings us up to date.
Mm-hmm. What's happened after all this.
Right, she brings us into the future. I wanted to ask you about Randall and autism, and how you were able to develop the information about autism, which was absolutely fascinating. Somehow I had pictured an autistic child as one like Randall, completely locked away, but at the same time not moving, not walking, just sitting, staring into space, but that's not the case.
Yeah, well, there's an incredible range of autistic behavior, actually, and I wanted him to be active enough and involved enough in the family's life to be a real presence. On the other hand, I didn't want him to be in a terribly arresting or interesting way autistic. I mean, there are, you know, idiot savants, as they called them, who, like the character in Rain Man, who speak and who have some particular kind of expertise that they can share with the world, some particular fascination with figures sometimes, or some sort of quirky mathematical gifts, things like that. But I felt that kind of autistic child would become a kind of center of the book in a different way, would become an oddity, would become someone whose illness itself was the fascination, which was something I was not interested in. So I created quite a particular kind of child, one who would be silent, would be but would be very much in people's consciousness, the members of the family, that is. Would be an actor, but not one who had kind of arresting and fascinating ways of acting. That would be a distraction, I thought.
Well, this picture of Randall, did it come out of your imagination, or did you actually apply a degree of research with regard to the character?
I read a lot of accounts of, written by parents, actually, of families with autistic children. And he's very like a child named Noah that a writer named Josh Greenfield has written three books
about. I've read
that
book.
Yeah, there's actually several. He's wrote one about the period of time when he was very young, and then actually the last one that I read anyway occurred, you know, really fairly recently when they were trying to really find a place for him, feeling they couldn't keep him at home any longer. And there are lots of ways in which Randall is similar to that, to Noah. I think he's less wild, perhaps. Noah really could be very violent and often very frightened and destructive, and I think Randall has one or two episodes of that, but that's not a major problem, a major issue with him in any way. But there are other accounts which I also read which helped me with the feeling that the family had, with the feeling that parents have with the stresses, although I think that book is also very useful in that way and very honest in that way, the Noah books are. But I was perhaps even more concerned with the response that people around such a child have. But reading is basically how I researched it.
You have a lot of explicit sexuality in the book. I don't think it was gratuitous, but you do risk being accused of being gratuitous, don't you, when you do things like that?
Yeah, I felt it was absolutely restrained. you know, I think that it's a... I feel as though it's an honest book, and it reflects, I hope, all the aspects of this life. And it seems to me one of the aspects of family life is your familiarity with the sexuality of people around you. Certainly, I felt that the parents' relationship in this family was bound to be affected sexually also by the presence of this child. I think I explore many of the other ways in which it's affected too, but it does have a tremendous impact on their sexual life together. And I think it particularly has an impact on Nina in a certain way. She's one of the three extra children, the three unexpected guests, and she feels in a certain sense as though her function in life is to be good, to be normal, not to cause problems, to somehow prove to her mother that her mother can have normal children, and that there's a way in which Nina chooses sexuality as a kind of arena to act out her anger about being forced into that position in the family, I think. But that also seemed natural and central to the way the book worked to me, and something I very much wanted to record as part of this family's life. So I thought there was just the bare minimum, actually, the bare minimum necessary.
Well, as I alluded to at the beginning of our talk, there are so many aspects in this family's life that are common to everyone, mm-hmm. and yet every family is very specific, too. So as I read the book, there were so many things that were similar to my own family's mm-hmm. background over the years that you can easily equate to, and yet, of course, they're specific. I mean, nobody in my family had an autistic child, for mm-hmm. example, and the locations were different and this sort of thing. But that's one of the wonderful things about fiction, because makes us share the thoughts and ideas of other people. Sometimes mm-hmm. you think you're all by yourself, but only we grow up in a certain way. But actually, there are so many similarities mm-hmm. among people, don't you think?
Well, I certainly think that there's a lot in any family's life that that someone from another family can recognize. But I think it's also the job of a fiction writer to imagine each character so carefully that the reader believes in the character and then can take that step, I think, perhaps, of identifying with a character, even a character who is somewhat different. But there, I think that some of that is really just the work that the fiction writer ought to be doing, essentially, or needs to do in order to engage the reader. That sense of identification is really produced by a sense of how real the character is, it seems to me.
Well, it was quite a task, though, because you moved backward and forward in a non-chronological way. Mm-hmm. It must have taken a lot of thought and effort to organize everything so that everything meshed. How did you do that?
I did do it some backtracking, but I wasn't working. I mean, I didn't begin at the beginning of this book and just write it very smoothly up till the end. I did have a sense of, the family. We had a lot of notes, and I had graphs, actually, of their ages during certain critical periods of time that I knew I was going to write about, so that I would, really have to think about what stage each character would be at, the way that each character would be talking. I mean, there are always six children and two adults in this family to be accounting for, although I sort of move some people off stage conveniently during various periods of time. But I did do an enormous amount, as I wrote, of backtracking. I would write one chapter and then think, well, I need to really show before this the father in a more sympathetic light, let's say. So I would go back and write a chapter that somehow I felt did that. So it was much less pushed by chronology and more by what I felt it needed. And so it was a very sometimes confusing book to write in that sense, except that I felt always that I knew the family and that I could imagine easily an earlier, a later stage in their lives, that it was just, a job I could assign myself, and that itself was not a problem. But sort of knowing what I needed to do, knowing what needed to be in the book, was sometimes a problem for me.
Well, Family Pictures is a terrific follow-up to The Good Mother. How did you like the film, by the way?
I didn't actually see the film. Because
you haven't seen the film?
No.
Would you like to borrow my tape?
No, I actually could go and rent a tape, of course. But I saw the previews a couple of times when I was, you know, watching other films, and realized that I really wanted to be able to go on imagining the book as I'd always imagined it. And I really feared, you know, the power of the visual image is so strong. I had a sense that if I saw the movie, I would always sort of have this visual overlay from it and not be able to remember the book or think of the book the way I prefer to remember it and think of it, which is the way it exists in my mind for me. I was actually, when it came out, I was still working on Family Pictures, actually, and thought I had some sort of mystical sense that it might be psychologically damaging to me as a writer to see this kind of translated version of my imagination, and that I somehow might be misfire in my brain or something permanently if I did it. But so I said to myself that I would see it after, perhaps after I'd finished writing this. But I honestly just haven't felt tempted, and I feel, if I feel tempted, I will. But I think that that's really how I end up standing on it, that I just feel more comfortable.
God, such restraint. I would be so
curious.
It's
not restraint. Well, I certainly have had plenty of reports from friends who liked it and friends who didn't like it, and you know, people who thought she was great, people who didn't think she was great.
Diane Keaton.
Yeah.
I thought she was terrific in it.
Well, I've heard just all over the map every kind of response you could name to it. But it isn't really a matter of restraint, though. It's just a matter of the kind of almost fear, I guess. So it isn't that I feel a tremendous impulse to see it. It's that I really don't want to see it. I'm not denying myself anything here.
Well, tell me how it all began for you. Did you grow up in a Chicago family not dissimilar to the one in Family Pictures?
Yeah, I mean, in the same sense that you say your family is not dissimilar. It was a large family. The locale is the same.
I should have been parenthetical a little bit when I was talking about the commonality of families, because I grew up in a white middle-class family, not dissimilar to the one here. Mm-hmm. But obviously, if I grew up in a coal mining family in Appalachia, then there would probably be some differences.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No. The locale is very much the same. I did grow up in Hyde Park, which is the neighborhood around the University of Chicago, on the south side of Chicago. And that's absolutely where the book is set. I grew up in a family of four kids with parents who are quite different from those. But in that my dad was an academic, not an expert on behavior or anything like that, or probably not even that interested in behavior, interested in history. But that sort of bump and tumble of family life was very familiar to me, and I was very conscious of wanting to work with that and wanting to work with the sense of the particular community and neighborhood that I grew up in. I mean, I think it was in a way a kind of unusual and fascinating kind of place and time to grow up, and I felt that my writing would be powered a little bit by memory, charged by it maybe, and so it was pleasurable in that sense to be working in that.
Well, your father was an academic. What did your mother do?
She was a faculty wife. She embraced this with tremendous enthusiasm, and there were just a sort of a whole community of wives who, you know, did all sorts of ancillary things at the university and, you know, ran, you know, fundraising things, and then she was also a mother of four children, which she took very seriously too.
So it's not surprising, growing up in a literate household like that, that you might one day be a writer.
Yeah, my mother was had written poetry in college, and really began to write again much later in her life. And I think she was a very sort of witty and articulate person, and very interested in language and words, and I think, you know, that a great deal of that I get from her. I mean, she's much quicker and sharper and wittier than I am, but I think that preoccupation and concern with language probably comes from her.
Did you go to the University of Chicago?
No.
Why not?
I wanted to get away from home.
But you'd probably get a cut-rate tuition there.
I think you did at that time. They had, I think, quite a generous thing, but I think we all felt like trying something else when we went to college, so I didn't go there.
Where'd you go?
I went to Radcliffe, mm-hmm. now called Harvard. I guess Radcliffe still sort of partly exists. But.
And you studied English?
Yeah, I wasn't a particularly distinguished college student, it must be said, and just sort of stumbled through. But I did study English, and I did take some writing courses in college. Again, was not did not have at all a distinguished record. So.
Did you have goals?
No, I think that was some of the problem. I just didn't know what would become of me. I mean, I'd written, always written, and I'd written a lot in high school, and I did write in college, but I never saw that as connected to something I could do that would sort of put food on the table. That seemed a kind of wonderful interest, and I didn't really know writers. I didn't perceive of it as a kind of possible profession, which probably was a smart way to think about it at that stage. But I really struggled to sort of figure out what it was that I would like to do and was very unclear on it. And I think that was some of the problem. I was very young and very confused about sort of what work I would like to have.
Well, most writers I've talked to don't really see writing as a profession. They see it something that they do in addition to their profession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's hard for many people to swing it as a writer. So
yeah.
They teach and have other work.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few who do do it on a full-time basis, but that's not to say I want to be a writer as a profession. Sounds like a tough row to hoe.
But I think some people, I think almost every writer understands that he's not going to be able to make it just doing writing, but I think some people are more able to say, I want to do something that keeps writing at the center of my life, which is something I was not saying to myself. I mean, I really at that stage thought of it as something I would always do way over here, but that I would need to find something that would be some work life that would be at the center of my life. And so I was making a kind of distinction, I guess.
Well, I was talking to Donald Westlake last week, and he's written almost 70 books.
Mm.
Sometimes he would write 3 or 4 a year so that he had to use pseudonyms.
Mm-hmm.
And he does write on a full-time basis, as you can see, and does nothing else. Because he's good. I mean, he's really good. He doesn't write the literary books. He writes mysteries and thrillers and science fiction and about anything. But he could do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's got such a gift with words and phrases that he probably could do it if he spent the time instead of turning out 3 books a year.
Yeah, there's a certain pressure that would put you under, I think, yeah.
Well, what did you do after Radcliffe?
I bounced around. I got married right after college and then had a series of sort of quite uncommitted jobs. I started off thinking I would teach high school English and did that for a semester and just was terrified. And so I stopped doing it and then had a series of kind of odd jobs for a while. And then I had a child and sort of gratefully, at that time there wasn't very much daycare or anything, so to work was not a very good option. And I was very grateful to stop for a few years and sort of think about life a little bit. And I enjoyed being a mother, staying at home actually with him for a couple of years, although I was very active and agitating for daycare and that kind of thing. And then I began to work in daycare out of a sort of a political activism and trying to get daycare. I increasingly found I enjoyed working with little kids, and I did that for a lot of years. I did that. I was divorced at that time, and I did that for 8 years, worked with little tiny children, which was a wonderful experience, and then began to write again with Mike.
In addition to the daycare?
Yeah.
Well, how did your first book was The Good Mother.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
I actually wrote that in 1983 and 4, and I'd gotten a fellowship in 1979 to Boston University, which was almost as much money as I was making that time in daycare. So I stopped working for a year and just
went to
school.
What was the fellowship for?
It was a creative writing fellowship. I'd seen an ad in the paper and saw the amount and thought if I could get it, I could not work for a year. I could just write, and I got it. And it was a wonderful year. I met a lot of other people who were interested in writing, which I hadn't known very many people from that world, really. And I just thought about writing and worked on my own writing for a year. And then after that, I did go back to daycare for a year, but I began to be able to have jobs teaching first composition, and then I had a story taken for publication, so I began to be able to have jobs teaching creative writing at various institutions in the Boston area. And I've sort of would piece together this kind of life out of a course here, a course there. You know, they pay $1,500, $2,000, $2,500 a course. So if you kind of get enough of them going in enough different places, you can make a salary for yourself. And I did that for a couple of years. And then in 1983, I got a fellowship called the Bunting Fellowship, which is an institution at Radcliffe College that funds people, mostly scholars, but they do have a few slots for writers or artists, too, women only, to just take a year and do whatever work it is that they're interested in doing. So I had a whole year with no work at all and got a very good running start.
They paid you for a whole year with no work at all?
Mm-hmm. I had an office, and it seemed to me an extraordinarily generous stipend. I think for people who come from an academic life where they really did have a salary, it was a bit of a come down to get this amount. It was $14,000, which seemed like a fortune to me. And an office, and I got, you know, a little allowance for someone to do some typing for me. It was great. It was heaven. And I got an awful lot of work done on The Good Mother, and finished it during the year after the fellowship while I went back to teaching.
You never went back to daycare?
I did right after I'd gotten my degree in creative writing, briefly. But I'd already begun, by the time I'd been doing it for 6 or 7 years, I was feeling old. I think it's a job that takes an enormous amount of constant energy, just a level of attentiveness, a level of constant concern and focus on the children you're taking care of. And I think it's very hard. It's hard to sustain it.
Now, I thought you were talking about the writing process. You're talking about taking care of children.
Yeah, to me, that's the most demanding work I've ever done.
More than writing?
Oh, yes. I mean, writing is feels self-indulgent next to that. I mean, I'm very aware of what a privilege it is to write. And writing, you're attending and paying attention to an internal life. There's something, you know, very turned in on it. It's a kind of play, you know, a pretending, really. Whereas doing something like daycare, you're asking yourself to attend very hard and with all of that same energy to someone utterly different from you, someone, in fact, 2 years old who doesn't really speak the same language you speak, and yet it's your job to understand what that language is and what the very private references are in every case, and to give that child a sense of being loved and cared for. Are 12 of them or so.
Sounds like the basis for a terrific book.
Well, I don't know. It's hard to imagine. I mean, there's a certain way.
A novel centered around a daycare situation? You know.
Who knows?
Yeah, I can see that coming up. But writing, it seems to me, it takes so much discipline, because nobody says, Sue, get in there and get next to that word processor and start to write. It's something that you have to start yourself and finish yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how many people really have the discipline to be able to force themselves to do something as private as writing.
Yeah, I think it is a curious act in that sense. And, you know, to sort of launch yourself into a project that you're going to have to sustain yourself through for several years without the assurance of there being necessarily anything at the end of it that will be worth anything to anyone but you is a very peculiar behavior, I think, in some way. And it's an odd thing to... I mean, it's clear, I think, that people have to love just the doing of it in order to be able to do it. And I think it is fundamentally playful. I mean, I think it is hard work, too. There is... The playful part is perhaps even more in imagining it, and then you do have to sit down and make words on the page reproduce the thing you've imagined in that carefree mood of play. And that's discipline, and that's labor, and that's work. I think there are people, writers, different from me, for whom the actual fooling around with words may be the more playful part. People whose language is denser, who have a kind of wider command of the use of metaphor, let's say, than I do. But for me, the most pleasurable part is actually probably before I actually begin to write, is the imagining. It's really the, like little children, you know, saying, okay, you know, you be the dad and I'll be the mom, and then I'll say this to you and you say this to me. And that's really the same kind of thing I think that writers do. You know, you say, okay, now I'm going to be him and I'm going to say, you know, and then you just think of this neat thing that someone can say to someone else that for you captures a whole aspect of their character that you've been sort of thinking about in a sort of disorganized way. You know, and it's that transfer from the sort of speculative thinking about character to being able to think of a line of dialogue, let's say, or a behavior that you feel expresses it. That's just tremendous fun.
But it's more, and with you, it's more than that, though. In family pictures, for example, you have very sharp images and smells, odors.
Mm-hmm.
You describe the odors of people and images of a crusted plate and things, little mm-hmm. things that add up to the drama of what's going on. A lot of people miss that. You know, that they can write a bare-bones story mm-hmm. without putting in the cobwebs that tend to give the mood and a sense of drama that's there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a more complex process than just coming up with
a
terrific line of dialogue.
Yeah. I think there's also the job of sort of being your own reader and saying, okay, what do I need to see on the page in order to believe in this universe, in order to see this universe as I've thought of it ahead of time, and being able to distance yourself enough from the creation to be the person reading too, and sort of say, this is missing still, this isn't here, I don't know what this room feels like to be in, and then to you know, be able to conjure those elements also that might make it feel real.
Have you been to Breedlove?
Mm-mm.
No. You've been to a number of writers' conferences, haven't you?
No, I've taught. I continue to teach writing now by choice, which is a privilege. I teach at BU, and I've gone once to a writer's colony, to the McDowell Colony, mm-hmm. for a couple of months.
That's a working place, though, isn't it?
Yes, that's a place where, you know, visual artists and musicians, composers and writers, poets come together. Well, they come together at dinner, and in the day they're supposed to be off in their little cottages in the woods, madly creating whatever it is.
Well, I know you have to leave at 12:40, so I'm going to just ask you one more question. And I always ask this question, and some writers love to respond to it, and others hate it. But do you have any advice for aspiring writers?
I think reading is the most important thing, probably, for writers to do, to understand how language works. And I mean, it seems to me that it's not an art you can be a primitive at. It's not like, you know, there aren't the Grandma Moseses of writing, really. It's something that you have to know something about, I think. It seems to me that the most helpful thing I ever did for myself was to teach published work and to make myself look at it that carefully and that hard, that I sort of knew how it was put together. That was the most.
So you're saying learn from others is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It has to be the right others, though.
Yeah, of course.
Family Pictures, beautiful novel. Sue Miller, thank you very much.
Thank you.